I know many of you are looking forward to a report on my ministry at Burning Man, and I promise I'll get to that in a moment, but I thought I might, might talk about the gospel first. So Jesus is on his way to Jerusalem. We're at a point in Mark's gospel where his Galilee ministry is over. He's told his disciples once that he was going to be crucified and die and rise again. And now he's journeying to Jerusalem. And halfway to Jerusalem, he tells them a second time. And then right before he enters Jerusalem, he tells them a third time. And we're in that middle point where Jesus has told his disciples for the second time that he was going to be handed over to other people. He was going to be killed, and then after 3 days he would rise again. And we are told by Mark that the disciples did not understand what Jesus was saying. And they were embarrassed. So they didn't ask him. They didn't say anything. They just thought, I'm just going to ignore, this is what he's talking about as we head to Jerusalem. And they didn't get it for good reason, I think, because it's the central mystery of Christianity. It makes no sense. Why in the world would the plan of God be that his Messiah be crucified and die? Why willingly enter into suffering? It makes no sense to us because our programming, how we are programmed to think and live and pattern our lives, is contrary. It is opposed. That is anathema. We our prime directive, perhaps, in our programming of our operating system, is avoid suffering. Don't suffer. If it hurts, don't do it. Avoid suffering, avoid suffering, avoid suffering, avoid suffering, avoid suffering. That's how I'm wired, at least. I don't want to suffer. And Jesus comes and says, I'm going to willingly enter into suffering. And by the way, if you want to really be alive, come along. We'll be fine. It makes no sense. But after sort of following Jesus, after allowing this story to enter my world and perhaps ponder it and think about it and pattern my life around it, I begin to see the wisdom in Jesus' words. Because life is hard. And we have a choice of either walling ourselves off from the hardness of it, the challenge of it, the pain of it, the suffering of it, and if we do that, we know that we end up living lives too small for us. The other alternative is to walk into our lives, to walk into relationships, even though we're in relationships with people that will disappoint us because they're people. And we're in relationships that will break our hearts because we're in love with people who will die. That living life wholeheartedly costs us. And it's painful. And what Jesus is saying is live that life anyway, wholeheartedly into the suffering, even if you know it's going to kill you or it's going to hurt. Because it's the only way to really live your life. And by the way, if you do, 3 days later, not right away, there's resurrection. There's new life. So stop letting fear rule your life. That's the first half of this gospel teaching. It's Jesus inviting us into to give ourselves over into human hands, even though doing so will hurt. Because it's the only real path. The other half of this gospel has to do with sort of our agenda about either, maybe my second prime directive is, garner esteem. And garnering esteem, by the way, is not the path to life. The path to life is giving esteem to others and honoring others and welcoming others, even those that society says are worthless or worthless. To welcome the outcast and the downcast. Mark's gospel is holding up these two ways as the path to life, the path of new life given to us in Jesus. Lean into, step into the human suffering, the human condition, the human world, and welcome even, particularly, the least and the lost.
So I went to Burning Man. And for those of you that don't know what Burning Man is, 5 weeks ago, I preached a sermon prior to leaving to let the congregation know about this adventure that I would be on. So you can listen to that sermon on our website to get a deeper understanding of what this was about. But I was going to Burning Man. It's my fourth time going. And this time, I and a group of other people were going to be creating the first Episcopal theme camp at Burning Man. And for those that don't know, 70,000 people go to Burning Man, and all of the stuff that happens at Burning Man happens by theme camps. Camps that it's a group of friends saying, wouldn't it be fun if we provided this experience? So there are, you know, theme camps that are bars, that are music venues, that are, you know, live music. There's trapeze camp. There's, you know, everything you can imagine. There's a camp that people have worked all year long to provide this experience. And our theme camp was a theme camp that would provide Christian fellowship and sacraments at Burning Man. We had morning prayer every morning at 10. We had we were open every afternoon from 2 to 4 for conversation, for people that wanted to talk. And we had four different services at the temple where we did Eucharist services. We did an Ash Wednesday service all at the temple. And the name of our camp was Religious AF, and that it would convey sort of the fact that we were religious, but we're not religious in the way that a lot of people might be scared of religion. And from the moment we arrived, we could tell that what we were doing was important. When we were setting up our camp, there was a camp right next to us of young adults who had been working on an art project, and one of them came over on the first day we were setting up our camp, came over to borrow a tool. And he said, what's the name of your camp? And we told him, and he said, well, what do you guys do? And we told him, and he goes, oh my goodness, I have got to talk to you guys. And, you know, 3 days later, he was in our camp in the afternoon asking questions about God and wanting to engage with us about what we had to offer. And we got that, like, wherever we went, we would hear people that say, oh, I heard of you. And we had one guy in our camp, he was standing in line at a camp that offered coffee in the morning, and he was talking to the guy next to him in line, and half hour later, that guy joined us for morning prayer. I mean, people were open and hungry for what we had to offer. We offered the first service that we had at the temple. We did a Eucharist service at the temple at Burning Man. And there was one guy who came because he saw it in the book of scheduled activities that Burning Man put out. And another guy came who just was passing by, saw that there was a service at Momai, and joined us. And one of our campers heard these two gentlemen talking to each other. And one of them said, when was the last time you've been to a communion service? And he answered, it's been 13 years. And the asker said, well, for me, it's been 35. And he never expected, like here at Burning Man, there would be a communion service. And because it was there, he felt an invitation to participate that maybe he didn't feel out in the world. Like, this would be a safe church for me to come to. I'll give you One encounter. Sunday night, we'd been there a few days. We'd set up most of our structures. The real activities weren't going to start until Monday. And Sunday night, most of our campers, there were about six of us, sitting in the living room, which was a room that we had constructed that was right on the street so people could see us
and come in and say hi and had our, the name of our camp. And we were sitting there chatting, sort of recovering after setting up all of our camp, and this guy came in and stood in our doorway. He was a large man, and he had sort of an aggressive posture. And he was wearing a bathrobe with nothing on underneath, and the bathrobe was open. Now, nudity is something that happens at Burning Man. It's not everywhere, but it happens, and it's not sexualized. It's just a clothing choice. And here's this guy with this clothing choice, but he had this sort of posture and demeanor, and we sort of greeted him with sort of, how are you doing? But in Burning Man language, it's, how's your burn? And instead of the usual, oh, it's fine, or whatever, he said, you know, it's pretty crappy, and he used some expletives. And the most experienced burner in our group was this woman who was one of the leaders of the camp, helped primary organizers, and she said later, she thought to herself, here we go. And the guy next to her, who was this was his first time at Burning Man, his response out loud was, you're in the right place. And he says, come on, you know, why don't you join us? So he comes and he sits down and he stays with us for an hour and a half and talks and talks and talks, and we have this engagement with him, and then he leaves. And then throughout the week, he comes back a couple of times and checks in with us and has a conversation. And then at the very end, when we were tearing down the camp, he came by and he said, I want to thank you guys, because talking to you really helped me get some perspective and turn things around for my burn, and he gave us some gifts. And that piece happened a lot. Like, we had conversations with people that were really meaningful. The reason I tell this story is because what was unique about this was I felt like, and reflecting on it afterwards, that his initial bid, like his initial entrance to our camp, I think was a test. When he came back later, he was fully clothed and he wasn't like that, but I felt like he was sort of testing us, like, are the religious people gonna accept me or not? And because we said, you're in the right place, he was like, oh, maybe I'm in the right place. And he had this conversation. We ended up, we had a sign outside our camp that said, may I bless you? And we learned, like, at 11 o'clock one night, we had to, like, take the sign down because people just kept, like, we couldn't get, like, stop it. We're out of blessing energy. Thank you very much. And when we would have our 2 to 4 in the afternoon open sign for conversation, we couldn't leave because people were there and they didn't want to leave, and they kept coming and talking with us. And I mention that for a couple of reasons. One is that going there makes me realize that people are hungry for what the church has to offer, and they don't expect it to come from here because they've been burned. They've had a bad experience in church. They don't think they're going to be welcomed in church. They're hungry, and when they see it out at Burning Man, they think, maybe this is a place where I can finally have that conversation and I'll be accepted and not judged. And my takeaway from that isn't that this is not important. This is critically important. But it's also important that we're there. That we're wherever we can be, to be agents of love and acceptance and grace out in the world for the people who are afraid to come here, who sadly don't expect the church to look like Jesus. And I know we're a church that looks like Jesus, hello. But we've done such a poor job as a church to look like Jesus that people don't expect to find Jesus. So it's important, even while we come here to be nurtured by the sacraments, to be part of a loving and gracious community that cares about the world, even though that is important, It's also important to find ways to be out in the world and welcoming people when they think the church is the last place that's going to want them. That's one of the things that I think relates to the second part of this gospel teaching about welcoming those on the margins. And we welcome the people on the margins who think they have no place here. We welcome Christ. But I want to reflect on the first part of Jesus' teaching, the part about leaning into the suffering of the world and being part of the suffering of the world and connected, like, with the experience of human suffering. And one of the things I didn't talk about 5 weeks ago when I preached about Burning Man was the temple. I wanted to save it for this sermon. At Burning Man, there is a temple. And the temple is this beautiful, large structure. I mean, at least it's bigger than this. And it's a beautiful structure. A different artist creates it every year. And the temple at Burning Man is the most popular thing at Burning Man. Everybody goes to the temple. Most people go more than once. And at any given time, it's often the most crowded thing. Place at Burning Man is the temple. Now, part of what makes the temple special is that everyone goes to the temple and they bring to the temple their prayers, their hopes, their laments, their fears, their anguish, and they write these prayers on the wall. So as you walk through the temple, you see, like, people's prayers written on the walls, all over the walls, and they bring mementos. There will be photographs. There will be ashes. There are wedding dresses. There are little, like, monuments and like, set up for people who have died. There are messages to people. And I want to read to you some of the things that I've seen written at the temple. R.I.P. my mom. Forgive. I love you still. I love you always. Daddy, with a picture of an older gentleman. I miss you more than words could ever say. You'll always be in my heart. I love you. And then in parentheses underneath it, you would be proud of me. I only pray each year the pain gets lighter. Hug them now. I'm sorry. Hey, Dad, I'm super effing sad. I wish there had been more time to fix things. And then next to it, thank you for who I am. This one struck close to home with my youngest child, my son, having left the nest. Farewell to my son's childhood. Harvey, I wish you could see the man I've become. And prayer after prayer after prayer. And people go to write their prayers. But then people also go just to be sort of inside the human heart. And to see, like, all of these prayers and hopes and laments and anguish, and any time you go, it will be full of people, and there will be groups of people, like four or five here that are praying together or sobbing together. They would have their own little ritual of farewell or goodbye or celebration. It's happening all the time. And these people who were at Burning Man, you know, maybe most of the time they're on the party bus. But there's a part of them that is calling them to the temple. And then the last thing that happens at Burning Man. Saturday night, the man is burned. It's a big party. There are fireworks. No one sort of knows what it means, but woohoo. Then the next night, the temple is burned. On Sunday night, the temple is burned. And by then, some people have left. So maybe it's 40,000 people gather around to watch the temple burn. And there's like a space, a safety space, and then there's this ring of people seated,
And then there's this ring of people standing. And then there's this ring of art cars and people sitting on their art cars. And the temple is burned, and the people are absolutely silent for an hour as this temple is burned. Now, we're in a culture where people are uncomfortable with silence that's any longer than 7 seconds. And here's a group of 40,000 people in absolute silence watching the temple burn for an hour. And the only thing you hear are like sobs. Different people sobbing, groups of people comforting one another, strangers comforting one another. And experiencing that was the closest that I've ever felt to my human family. Like 40,000 people, all heartbroken, and all sort of connecting in this place of our own brokenness, because we all know what it feels like to be brokenhearted, to be lonely, to miss someone we love. And it's in that place, and that experience helped me realize that our primary point of connection as humans is not in our ideology, clearly not in our politics, or in our religion. Our primary point of contact and connection as humans is in our brokenness and in our suffering. I mean, when we're suffering together and brokenhearted together, we're like one. I was one with those 40,000 people. And in that moment, we had each other's backs. There was something like real about it, and that's why people were drawn to the temple. In this place where there's all this crazy going on, the temple was the one realest place on the planet where you could see the reality of people's hopes and dreams and brokenness and brokenheartedness. Trade secret. Priests, for the most part, prefer funerals over weddings. Because when people come to funerals, they're coming with their broken heart and they're wanting to connect around their brokenness, which is what we do. When people come for weddings, not that weddings aren't joyful and lovely and that we don't enjoy sort of working with this relationship of love, but so much of the energy in the room is about the pictures and the party. There's something real about coming together in our brokenness and our brokenheartedness that I experienced at Burning Man and experienced on a massive scale when the temple burned. And I think that points to what Jesus is talking about in this passage, which is if you want to live your life, if you want to really live your life, you can't do it if you're constantly stepping away from the broken places. To live your life, to truly live your life in communion and community with other people, you have to pick up your cross. You have to pick up your own brokenness. You have to walk to your own Jerusalem, because it's a Jerusalem that we all share. And it's the one place where the deepest parts of ourselves are connected with one another and with God. So to realize that that's it, that the path to life is to enter into our suffering and not exclude anyone from our communion as we do it, because that's the one thing we all share, whether someone's wearing clothes or not, is this place of brokenness and yearning. And meeting there, my friends, is the kingdom of heaven. Amen.